and it's KVC Arts Now on KVCR. Arts and entertainment as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. On this edition of the program, we welcome Sarah Brightman with a few stops in our region quite soon. She'll be at Fantasy Springs Resort and Casino in Indio December 7th, down to the San Diego Civic Center on the 8th, and at the Dolby Theater in Hollywood December 15th. First, though, also in the region soon at the Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga, Paul Reiser once again. It was Reiser for the entirety of last week's show, but there was so much to talk about with him, we were starting this edition of the program with, well, what I couldn't fit last week. Just ahead, Reiser's very recent work on Stranger Things, and some not-so-recent stuff as well. This is such a sidebar, and you may not know or remember, but one of the bits that I revisited over the last week or so, a long time ago, it's long enough ago that you were wearing really big shoulder pads on your jacket. The thing is, though, is that your bit was about having neck issues or the muscles connected to the neck
because
of shrugging, because I don't know.
Yeah.
And the thing is, those shoulder pads really emphasized the shrugging of the shoulders.
No, I forgot about that bit. Yeah, that was like my shoulder surgery because I didn't know anything. And anybody asks you, you go, well, I don't know.
All
keep
right.
Shrugging.
One thing on working on the other side of the lens, as it were, with There's Johnny and some of your other things for that matter, but any discoveries you recall making that might apply to the category of, oh, that's why the director hated it when I did that sort of thing?
You know, you certainly get a different perspective when you're on the other side. You know, I think one of the revelations to me was in casting. You know, for any actor, when you're starting out, or not even starting out, when you're going up for a job, which is basically anybody but the big stars who get offered things, you know, here you go, it's yours if you want it. Most of the time, and 90% of people are going in and auditioning, and even if they're great and accomplished, they want to know, gee, are you right for this particular role, and what do you look like today, and, you know, so on. And one of the things that became clear for me when I was on the other side, and you're the guy and the producer on the couch, or you're the creator and actors are coming in, you want them to do well. You want the guy who walks in, or the actress who walks in, nothing you want more than, please be the one for this. I want to give you this role. I want to be done looking. And so, you know, we come in nervous as actors. It's like, I hope they like us. Like, they already like you. You know, they want it to be you. And so that was an interesting perspective. And sometimes, you know, you go, whoa, that person is great. And I've had friends come in. I go, wow, I love this guy. I don't think he's not right for this. Or I had somebody else. I had a different thing in mind. And sometimes you don't get a role, not because you weren't good, but just they have something else in mind.
Sure.
And so you learn to not take it personally and recognize that. So that was a bit of an education for me.
Nice. Well, that's wonderful advice for anybody, especially in this region. I have to address Stranger Things for just a bit. You played Dr. Samuel Owens. So two different things that if you could sort out for me. I heard you talking to Conan O'Brien once when you were talking about they called and had a part that they thought could be good for you, but then I read somewhere else that this part was actually written for you.
Well, I don't know if they wrote it to give me work. I think a lot of times you write, you just have an actor in mind, and it helps fuel it. So they were picturing, they told me, they were picturing me. In fact, in their original draft, it was called Dr. Reiser. You know, sometimes, you know, I do that too, and I'm writing. I'm just like, yeah, well, what if that was Julia Roberts? All right, call her Julia.
Nice.
And then it just gives you an image as you're writing.
Oh, cool.
And then they got to the end and apparently said, well, we should probably call Reiser, so we don't have to change the name. And so they met me, and it was right after, it was literally days after the first season had dropped. And of course, my son had watched all episodes in the first weekend and told me about it. So that on Monday morning, when my agent calls, said, have you heard of this new show, Stranger Things? I said, of course I have. I have a son. He tells me what to watch. And he said, well, they want to meet you. I said, you're kidding. And we had lunch, and they were very vague. I said, well, is this guy a good guy or a bad guy? And they go, we don't know.
Interesting.
I said, well, you mean you actually don't know or you don't want to tell me? They go, no, we don't know. Which was a very interesting thing to play because if you don't know yourself what you're thinking, I'm like, well, that makes you be a little bit mysterious. You know, and as it happened, the audience goes, well, I don't trust this guy. because I saw Aliens 30 years ago, so I already don't trust this guy. And Matthew Modine was a horrible doctor, so I think this guy's going to be horrible. And then you go, oh, wait a minute, he's actually kind of nice, and he's taking care of the kid.
Yeah.
So it's been a great experience.
Listen, a very interesting thing about Dr. Owens is that he... For those who haven't watched it, Owens is basically, he's a good guy who works for a bad company, I'd say, or a morally gray area, some people might say. But when we first met you, it was a noble cause. You helped the sheriff, Hopper, to adopt Eleven, and so there were good things about you.
Yeah, and I think there was actually nothing bad about him, other than you presume he's going to be bad, because that's what Modine was, and that's what Dr. Brenner was, and that's what Burke was, and, you know, it has such an 80s vibe, Stranger Things. I always thought that must have been why the Duffer brothers were thinking of me. It's like, well, aliens, like a guy who's creepy or you don't like. And, but the twist is, guess what? He's actually a good guy.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of fun to play. You know, and I was very aware that the character is going to be viewed negatively and suspiciously, which is great to play against.
Was this the kind of thing where you only got any of your knowledge of the character script by script, or was there any point where they told you any kind of a much larger story arc?
No, they never did. And I think they were always busy writing next week's script. I mean, they had an idea where they were going, but there was nothing really to share, and so they didn't tell me too much. And in fairness, I think a lot of times they would surprise themselves. They would plan something and then go, ooh, maybe we go this way. And so they didn't share too much with me anyway. I'm not sure what they did with, you know, Eleven and Hopper. They might have shared more of their goal. But from the beginning, they knew they were going to be 5 seasons. And this next one promises to be the biggest. It's taken the longest. And it was always meant to be the finale.
So okay.
So, I can't wait to see it myself.
Well, they were truly, I mean, so many cliffhangers on this.
Yes.
So just, yeah, this is something that people would be watching. I know that everybody that I talk to about Stranger Things, they're either saying, I can't wait, or they're saying, 3 years, come on. So, wow. Well, I'm glad it's about to happen again.
Yep, it'll be out. I don't know when. I think probably in the summer.
Wow. Mad about you, just one thing about that. I know that you were part of the creative team. Were you therefore then part of the decision in keeping Lisa Kudrow on as a recurring character so that she would be the twin sister of Phoebe when Friends came about a couple of years
later? Yeah. Lisa Kudrow was cast in one of the first 10 episodes or so of Mad About You. We had a flashback to my dating years. And I was saying, oh, I have all these blind dates, and I'm ready to meet the woman I'm going to marry because I'm so tired of these blind dates. And then we showed a scene of the last blind date that I had was with Lisa Kudrow's character. And she didn't have much to say, but she was so funny and so original, so offbeat. And I remember the line, we were sitting there trying to make conversation. And she said, what do you do? I said, oh, I'm a documentary filmmaker. And she goes, oh, that's interesting. I work in a bank. It's not that funny. It's not funny. But the way she did it was, oh my God, that's so funny. I work in a bank. Yeah. As if they're connected. I went, that's the most bizarre line reading. Geez, that's funny. Oh my. And we all went, this woman is funny. And I had never met her before. So we just said, we got to bring her back to the show. So suddenly we made her, Ursula, we made her. It's so funny. We brought her back as the waitress in the place where we would go. But I don't know if we mentioned the fact that she was my last blind date. I don't think so. I think we just brought her as a new character. But anyway, I remember once, somewhere in that first season, or second season maybe, she had to leave early. She had an audition for a new show, a pilot. I said, well, what's it about? She goes, oh, it's 6 friends and they all live in the same building. Oh, yeah, well, that's stupid. That's never going to be a hit. Cut to. And then, you know, it was delightful that she decided they were actually going to be twin sisters. And so there was this crossover. And I think she still did a couple of episodes for us when she was already doing Friends. She's just uniquely funny and wonderful.
And then Helen Hunt as Jamie, I think, even walked into Central Perk at some point.
Yes,
so that was just fun.
Tell me who can stop my heart as much as you. it's really true this time. I don't have the answers. I don't have a plan. All I have is you, so baby, help me understand.
What do we do?
You can whisper in my ear.
Where we go?
Hey, who knows what happens after here? Let's take each other's hand.
Okay, to wrap then, this gives me a great excuse to be playing Anita Baker in the background, having just spoken a little bit about Mad About You. Final Frontier, written by you and Don Was.
Yeah.
My first thoughts of Don Was, due to my age, I suppose, would go to Was Not Was and
yeah.
Everybody Do the Dinosaur.
Yeah.
How did you even end up working with Don Was?
It's another silly happy accident along the lines of walking into diner.
Mm.
2 weeks before Mad About You was to premiere. This is 92. It was either late August or early September. It was really close to the premiere. Helen Hunt and I were on our way to New York to do some publicity. And we're in the airport lounge, and I see this long-haired, freaky-looking guy with the cowboy hat and flip-flops. And I go, who's this guy? And Helen goes, oh, I know. And she knew him because they had a mutual friend or something. And so we're chatting with him, and I said, oh my gosh, that's Don Was. And I knew his work with Bonnie Raitt, and he's a wonderful producer and musician. So we started chatting, and I said, we have an idea for a theme song, but I don't like it. It's a temp. I wish we had a better one. And he said, we're getting ready to board a plane. He said, well, why don't we write one?
Hmm.
Well, you know, it's in 2 weeks. He goes, well, we can do it tonight. I said, well, it'd have to be after, you know, I'm not free till 9. He goes, yeah, come by at 11. I said, what do you mean? So this guy wouldn't take no for an answer. I said, I'd love to do that, to write it with you. My God, that would be great, but we have to do it fast. And so he's just so easygoing and positive. So I went to the studio where he was actually finishing recording session with Felix Cavallari of the Rascals. And I went, he said, you know, Felix? I said, yeah, geez, hello. And then I was him. He goes, what do you have? I said, well, I don't know. I have just this idea, like it should start with this little bongo beat. That's all I had. And then I had these chords. And so we recorded a thing with no words. I didn't have any words.
Yeah.
We just got the theme, and he was playing guitar, and I was playing piano, and then we did like two tracks. Took the cassette, and on the plane 2 days later going home, I wrote lyrics. And then the day after that, he gathers like these top-notch musicians, all of Bonnie Raitt's band and Lyle Lovett's band and Andrew Gold to sing it.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know he was recording. He said, well, just show it to the band. So I'm playing piano. And I said, all right, let's try one. He said, no, I got it. I said, wait, you recorded that? He said, yeah.
Nice.
So like, I went, this guy is sneaky. And that was it. And it became such a piece of my life. And, you know, I found out years later, so many people have approached me and said, you know, that was the theme song at our wedding. That was our wedding song. And I went, oh, my goodness, I had no idea. And then we re-recorded it with Anita Baker,
yeah,
which was wonderful. And then years later, when we did our little revisit 5 years ago,
yes,
I love it, did a duet with Keisha Lewis, who was actually also an actress in the reboot. Wonderful, wonderful Broadway singer. And it was a kick. I thought, that song has legs. It worked with Lyle Lovett. It worked with Anita Baker. Anita was really sultry and sexy. It was really cool to do that with her.
Without a doubt. And I'm a jazz nut as well. And so to catch the version with Anita and, oh, Kevin Eubanks.
Oh, yeah, we played
Smitty Smith.
The Tonight Show, yeah.
So I was seeing all these players before I even realized, oh, that's the Tonight Show. Okay.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Well, Paul, we didn't even look at your books. You've got three wonderful books out there that go in a wonderful succession between couplehood, familyhood, and then finally babyhood. I'd love to maybe do something again in the future on this.
We'll come back and we'll do that. And let's not forget to tell people to come to the Lewis Family Playhouse.
Absolutely, Lewis Family
Playhouse. You're going to hit that.
PaulReiser.com. You're also on Facebook and Instagram. Are you a tweeter as well?
You know, I'm a lazy tweeter, periodically.
Okay.
I know I'm supposed to be doing it more, and I don't, but I try.
Okay. All right.
All right, Dave. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. I had a great time, and this is going to be great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Paul Reiser will be at the Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga December 21st. More at PaulReiser.com, also LewisFamilyPlayhouse.com.
I'm David Fleming with you for KVC Arts. Sarah Brightman has several stops in the region quite soon with her Christmas Symphony Tour. And Sarah, before talking about the Christmas Symphony Tour, I'd like to go into this with something that I just learned. Now, people associate you with musical theater, notably Cats and Phantom, but I just saw an old interview of yours with Jonathan Ross where you said, at that point, you'd only been in 3 musical theater shows, and also you'd really only auditioned for this type of thing because the pop disco thing had kind of taken a dive. Your words, not mine.
A very long time ago.
Yes.
Trained as a classical singer and also a dancer.
Yeah.
I happen to, in my very early age, have had 2, I suppose they were disco hits at that time, and they got to sort of like number 6, number 1. We're talking about Europe here. So I had a short career in that world, but of course, you know, I was a teenager and that all went downhill. So I ended up doing what I should be doing, which was going on the stage and doing a musical. And I think I got very well known for musicals in the Western Hemisphere anyway, because the 3 that I did were incredibly well known, and 2 were big hits like Cats and Phantom. And, you know, I originated the role. So
yes.
A lot of people think of me that way. But of course, in the rest of the world, I've had many sort of hits and done very, very interesting other things, which they know me for. So, you know, have to be a bit schizophrenic in my life here.
That's a beautiful way of putting that one. Oh, wonderful.
So this is Christmas. And what have you done? Now the year over, the new one's just begun. And so this is Christmas. I hope you have.
Your Christmas Symphony Tour, I think your first holiday release was 2008 with A Winter Symphony. Has there been a Christmas or holiday symphony tour consistently since then? I mean, beyond the height of COVID, that is.
Well, actually, a negative thing like COVID that this live show came to be, it was at the beginning of COVID and everyone was really miserable. And all my musician friends that I worked with, they were all out of work. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do something positive here. I've always wanted to do a Christmas show. I'm going to try and put one together. And we found a beautiful old church in London and got from all our local authorities that we were able to do it during COVID. And everyone was spaced apart. And we filmed it. And I put it online and people could donate to charities. And it became so successful that TV companies all around the world wanted to take it on for their channels. And I thought, well, actually, I'd really like to do a tour with this show because it was very personal to me. And we started during the later part of COVID, actually. And we didn't have big audiences because everyone was still a bit scared.
Yeah.
And then we took it to the East. And we keep bringing it back and more people enjoy it. And it is a lovely show because it's very personal. And I've taken huge responsibility in sort of taking into account people's emotions at this time of year. I mean, people are emotional and they want to be sort of transported for a couple of hours into a Christmas realm or a holiday realm. So I love big orchestras and choirs at Christmas. I have a big orchestra and a big choir, and I've got all this wonderful lighting that shows all the sort of colours that we want to see at Christmas. And my gowns are beautiful and glittery. It's a fun and very beautiful experience to come and see it. People really enjoy themselves. So that's kind of it in a nutshell, really. Some beautiful classical pieces in a kind of Christmas mode, to some religious songs, party time songs, beautiful ballads and pieces like that that actually take into account that sometimes people are sad at Christmas. They've maybe lost a loved one or something. So it's very poignant pieces. So it kind of has something for everybody.
I saw this on one of the past tours or videos somewhere. I believe in Father Christmas. Is this part of the lineup this year?
It is. I love singing that song. Again, a very personal choice because, you know, it's Troika and Prokofiev there. And I do remember when I was a teenager listening to that song for the first time in the radio and just loving it because I love the sort of mixture there of sort of like, I think it was Greg Lake, wasn't it?
Yes.
And the classical as well mixed in. And actually, it's been a little bit of what I've done myself. I mean, I'm a sort of hybrid of a lot of things. I'm trained, but I use pop music, but sing it in my own way. And so I think I was attracted to that kind of thing. And I quite enjoyed the message at that time that it's portrayed. And I just thought it would be a great thing to bring in from an era into the show. So there are lots of fun little pieces there. And that one, for example, is a bit of a historical piece, but
yes,
it's wonderful. That's just an example. And I do bring in all of my hits. So people that, if they like their music, they get to hear the hits as they always like to hear.
That's one of the things that really strikes me with I Believe in Father Christmas. That's what I love so much is the build and the build as it goes. I really appreciate arrangements. Were you a major part of the arrangements, or were you purely another instrument in someone else's vision of this arrangement and this build and build?
When it comes to arrangements, I'm pretty hands-on. I don't write arrangements myself, but I have a good feeling of what's needed. I mean, us as Brits, I mean, in our sort of like rock or pop world, we're very anthemic in what we do. A lot of our pieces are very anthemic, and I think, you know, that's sort of in the DNA almost. So I love seeing films and I love those sort of big productions.
Without a doubt. Something that I would love to hear about is one of my favorite classical pieces, Albinoni's Adagio in G minor, which became Anytime, Anywhere from your album Eden. The thing about this, you're using two different types of voices, chest voice and then head voice. And so I'm wondering if this is actually a conscious thing by this point, where you have in your mind's eye where the resonation is going to be.
I actually work very organically with that. If a piece feels that it needs a little chest voice, I'll use it. In my training, because I trained as a classical singer, I know it's got a form, but classical singers are allowed in their world to go into chest voice if the piece actually calls for it. And we can actually do it in a very, very healthy way where it isn't pressing on the larynx. I mean, it all gets very technical, but there are ways to portray songs in different ways. And actually, classical training, I found, really helped me because I was able to protect everything at the same time with the training, as well as give a different kind of texture to pieces that actually needed them. Because at the end of the day, although I've seen a lot of pieces that are already known, be able to portray something in your voice which is very real, organic, and there's a reason why you're singing that song. So I'm very careful about that. And probably why I've been quite successful in all the pieces from Time that I've chosen to do, because it's the song that comes and the piece of music that always comes first in my mind.
Oh, well stated, well stated. Sarah Brightman will be at Fantasy Springs Resort and Casino in Indio December 7th, down to the San Diego Civic Center on the 8th, and at the Dolby Theater in Hollywood December 15th. More dates at sarahbrightman.com. A reminder again that Paul Reiser will be at the Lewis Family Playhouse in Rancho Cucamonga December 21st. More at paulreiser.com as well as lewisfamilyplayhouse.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Paul Reiser and Sarah Brightman. And here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Sandy Hodela, Zach Mays, and Shireen Awad. For more going on in the region, you can visit our events calendar at our homepage, kvcrnews.org, or you can go directly there at kvcrnews.org/calendar. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming, with thanks especially to you for listening and for your support. Give anytime at kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.